Tales of Red Clay Rambler podcast is now available on Stitcher Radio On Demand. Stitcher is an award-winning free mobile app that lets you listen to all your favorite shows, plus discover the best new podcasts from around the web. Stitcher's easy-to-use app lets you create playlists of your favorite shows, and the best part is that they play continuously without you having to change any settings. This is perfect for artists like us who have our hands in clay and don't want to stop working to fiddle around with our iPhones. Stitcher is available for iPhone, Android, and most tablets. If you don't have Stitcher already, download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Welcome to the Tales of a Red Clay Rambler podcast, featuring interviews with culture makers from around the world. This is Ben Carter. I'm going to be your host. If you'd like more information on the show, please visit our website, talesofaredclayrambler.com. Welcome back to episode 80 of the podcast. Thank you guys for tuning in. This week on the show, I am honored to have Andrew Baseman. This is an interesting conversation that's a little bit off of our normal path of talking to artists. Andrew is actually a collector of make-dos. Now, a make-do is an object that has been repaired in an unusual way. It can be everything from, like, let's say a plate that cracks in half, and then you have a metal staple on the back that holds those pieces on, to, like, let's say a little teapot where the handle was knocked off and then there was a metal spoon that was bent to be the new handle. What's fascinating about these objects for me is that they come from a time that is foreign to our current era of disposability. Back then, if you broke one of your china plates, you were not going to get a whole new set of dinnerware. You were going to do everything you could to fix that plate. And in fact, what you're going to do is you're going to take it to a tinkerer, and then they were going to actually try to fix it with staples or whatever method, and then you were going to use it along with a whole other set of china dinnerware that you had. That is the exact opposite of our lives now. You know, if you break your cell phone, you just throw it away and get a new one, or you take it to Verizon or whatever your phone carrier is, and then they throw it away and give you a new one. I like the idea that these objects were so precious that a lot of energy and a lot of time and sometimes a lot of money was put into fixing this object and getting it back to be used as soon as possible. Andrew is a collector of objects, but he is also an interior designer with a design firm in New York City. During the day, he is the set decorator for the TV show Gotham, which you guys might recognize from Fox. That's the prequel to the Batman series, and if you watch one of those episodes, you can see how Andrew and the team there have decorated that space to create a feeling and an ambiance. So it's really interesting to talk to someone that's not only a collector, but that is deeply invested in the idea that objects can create a feeling or an atmosphere. Now, Andrew has been documenting his collection of make-dos through his blog, which is called Past Imperfect, The Art of Inventive Repair. If you guys would like to check out Andrew's work or to read his blog, you can go to andrewbaseman.com. Past Imperfect is just at andrewbaseman.com/blog. Without further ado, we'll get to the interview. So what I wanted to start with actually is an explanation of what a make-do is, because your awareness of inventive repairs is much bigger than most people. So can you explain what it is you're interested in with a make-do?
Well, a make-do, I believe, is an American term, and it simply means you're making do with what you have. In World War II, it was used to mean repurposing old clothes and making quilts out of them, or taking a flour sack and making something functional out of that. So make-do really means just taking something that's broken and making it work again. And sometimes it could be as simple as an old spoon, turning that into something to use in the garden, or just anything. You can turn something that started out its life as one object and turns into something else. So there's a lot of various definitions for that or explanations for that.
And when did you first see a piece that was repaired?
I believe I saw one during a field trip, a school trip. To a museum, and I saw an old Egyptian pot with big metal staples on it, and I just was fascinated by that, first by the age of the piece and that it was repaired, and that in a museum with seemingly perfect items, this had big metal straps all over it. So it was just fascinating, and I wondered how they did that and why they did that, and it just always stayed with me. And then years later, in my own house, I found a piece, because I was interested in antiques at a very early age. I just stumbled upon something of my parents, and I asked them about it, and they didn't really know how it was done, but they also loved the fact that it was quirky and that it was had survived all these years, a piece of china that was stapled together. So it was great to find something in my own house.
And you were talking about that Egyptian piece and about how everything else in the museum was perfect and pristine, and then the Egyptian piece had been repaired. It's interesting. In some ways, you think of perfection as being an untarnished object. And on the other hand, you can think of perfection as being something that was so special that it was used, it was cherished, it was loved, and therefore it was repaired. So how do you think when you're going into a museum, I mean, after you're a collector of objects, but when you go into a museum, how does your collection in your mind change the way you look at the museum space?
When I go into a museum, I love to be surprised, and I'll think to myself, well, I'm not interested in such and such. I'm not even going to go in there. But then I will, and then see things that I've never seen before and be inspired by the colors or the shapes or the purpose. I just love seeing things for the first time. And as I get older, it's harder and harder to find that. But it's great when I'm surprised. And when I first started collecting, I would go into a museum and think, oh, if only there were price tags on these things, it would be great to own everything. But then, of course, you can't own everything, even though it seems like I already do. My house is filled to the brim with a lot of my collection. And But I just love seeing things that I wouldn't necessarily want to own, that I can go to a museum and get my share of it there.
Let's talk about the economics of your collection. You have, maybe you should just actually explain how the collection started and what it is now, because it seems to me that these are high-class objects, but I might be wrong about this. Were these originally objects that were used in the middle class? Or
most of the pieces I have, well, I believe they were all cherished. Otherwise, if something broke, they would throw it out. So there was something about the piece, be it sentimental value or that it was an expensive piece and they wanted to be preserved. Whatever it was, things break. And to have it repaired, you can try it yourself. And the results vary. Sometimes those are the most whimsical examples. But if you had great wealth, you would take your piece to a silversmith. So if a Canton jug from the 18th century, the handle broke off, you would take it to a silversmith and they would fashion a beautiful, unique handle, sometimes embellished to match the body of the piece, other times more whimsical, and the shape, it took on a new form. So the wealthy would take it to, or sometimes a goldsmith, whatever they could afford, the most they could afford, they would have repaired in that manner. Other pieces were repaired by itinerant tinsmiths who would fashion cheaper versions of what the wealthy had, but still functional. So your stoneware pitcher, rather than your 18th century porcelain, would now have a tin handle and it could function again. So I think it's a matter of preserving and being able to use the pieces again. They don't just go on a shelf and collecting dust, they're back on the dinner table being used.
And do you think that if these people, it goes back to that idea in a museum that you have something pristine and then you have something that's been repaired and the comparison between the two. If you were in, let's say, an English manor home in 1890 and they had you know, six pieces of dinnerware, do you think that they would actually be using the repaired piece with in the same setting as the
By the that time, if you want to be really specific, mm-hmm. by the late 19th century, no. But if you had a place setting for 50 of Chinese export ware and a piece became damaged, you would proudly use the damaged piece that had been repaired because it still shows you have great wealth. And not only could you afford the piece, but you could afford to take it to a silversmith and have a beautiful silver repair. So it becomes even more special, I think.
Right.
But later on, I think there was some shame in that. And so it became, if it's broken, it's no good. Get rid of it. Give it away. Throw it away. So I think later on, the pieces were not put back into service.
It seems like your collection in some way tracks the way that culture thinks about objects. When you're talking about those early pieces, the actual silver that was used to fix them, if you were really wealthy, being able to fix anything with silver is such a status symbol. I mean, I've never thought about that when I was watching your lecture, versus later on they either might not use it or might fix it, use it with tin, which mm-hmm. has a very different connotation. But I keep thinking about status and wealth and the display of porcelain being wealth. Can you talk a little bit about that as a collector of make-dos, but also just your knowledge of antiques is much greater than the average. So can you talk about the impact of porcelain as a status symbol?
Well, I think porcelain came about, it was done in China and it was imported, and it took sometimes 2 years to get your order filled. So you would order a service. If you were aristocratic, you would have your coat of arms put on it. That became armorial china, and you would have it designed. Sometimes the results would not be exactly what you wanted, because if you wanted a pastoral scene or something, or a portrait, by the time the Chinese interpreted it, it would have more of an Asian flair than an English flair. So sometimes you wouldn't end up what you wanted, and then you'd have to wait another 2 years to get it back. So they were shipped. You know, it was a very long process.
And so in terms of this, I've never thought about essentially what was happening is there were Chinese means of production for porcelain, mm-hmm. and then there were English people or European people. But what was the middle ground like? How did the actual message get conveyed to the Chinese craftsmen, this is what we want? Were there brokers?
There were brokers who did that specifically. It opened up a whole new market. And the Europeans were able to do a certain type of low-fired pottery. Mm-hmm. They weren't able to achieve porcelain. So English pottery was stoneware, and it was much cruder. It was fired at a lower temperature, so you couldn't get those glass-like surfaces, and you couldn't get the same kind of detail. So early pieces from the 17th century, the Dutch, the Delftware, their version of blue and white was very lumpy and very thick and heavy, and by the time Chinese porcelain was being done, they were copying the Chinese. So the Delftware was blue and white, copying the early Chinese blue and white, but the results weren't the same, and they weren't as refined.
I got to, I was in, I think, Tokyo, and went to the Mingei Museum there, which is generally handcrafted objects by unknown craftsmen. That's kind of the whole thought behind the Mingei movement, but they had some of that early Delftware, and I had no idea how rudimentary it was. Like, it was really coarsely made plates in blue stamped pattern, but you could tell that it was maybe a wood block stamp. I'm mm-hmm. not sure. The registration of the stamps is nothing compared to, like, later transferware mm-hmm. or even what people could do by hand.
Right. I'm surprised. I thought a lot of that was done by hand. So I guess later on, to speed up the process, they would do some kind of a template or
right.
pattern.
Well, maybe it was by hand then.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell.
But it was very crude, and the colors would run. Right. And because they were more porous, they would break easily. Mm-hmm. And then these are the pieces that I see that are repaired. They've got very large, crude repairs to support the weight of the piece.
Hmm. The international economy of all of this is really interesting to me, because I'd imagine by the time exportware in the 17th century you're talking about, or even maybe into the 16th century, when would you define the beginning of exportware as we know it in terms of European desire and Chinese exportware coming out?
Well, I'm more of an expert in the repairs, so
okay.
I believe it was late, probably mid to late 17th century.
Okay.
And there were tariffs, and there was a lot of political upheaval that caused to cease the monopoly on some of the manufacturers and the shipping and taxes. I mean, there's a lot of that I'm not as familiar with, but that did cause the change in how pieces were produced and imported, and then to combat that, things were done locally instead. So, but it seems that Chinese export really was coming in the late 17th century through the, I would say, early, probably the mid 19th century.
Okay. Because the reason I was asking about the dates is China generally, I lived in China and would go to the museums and look at the porcelain collections. And the earliest porcelain that we would consider to be actual porcelain, like full-on porcelain, that was leaving the country was like 900-ish. So when you got from 900 to 17th century, it's interesting to think about all these years of this slow migration in terms of shipping through the Middle East and the Silk Road and the Maritime Silk Road and, you know, all this distribution channels. By the time they got to the 17th century, they really had it down
mm-hmm.
in terms of how to get these products back and forth, because it's not like what it is today when we think about being able to FedEx your order.
Right.
You know, like you said, 2 years to have it made,
mm-hmm.
which I imagine at least 3 or 4 months of that would be the shipping itself.
Right. And all those ships never made it.
Mm.
So many pieces were lost at sea, and then over the years they would be found. There's some very famous cargoes that were are sitting at the bottom of the ocean, and they brought the pieces up. And then talk about supply and demand. These were once rare pieces, but if there's a cargo with now hundreds, if not thousands, of blue and white plates, then the demand has lessened because there's too many now.
Sure.
But there's still 18th century or 17th century pieces in mint condition.
Mm.
So it's interesting how that happens.
So going back to your activity as a collector, how did you first establish a network or at least a place to go to get the objects that you're interested in?
That was the hardest part. When I first started collecting, I was going to England a lot and finding pieces there, because there really wasn't the appreciation here. I would go to shops and ask for repaired pieces, and a lot of the dealers would look at me like I was crazy. Like, why would you want that? And even when I explained it, they still didn't understand that I find beauty in the repairs. They either thought I was trying to get the pieces cheap and take the repairs out and repair them with blind repairs, which can be done now. But I tried to convince them that no, I really like the staples and the metal handles, and so it took a long time for that to come around. But I found in London especially that dealers were more apt to appreciate the value of porcelain even with the repairs, and so they weren't banished to the bargain shelf. They were displayed amongst the perfect examples. They were luckily much cheaper, and that's how I could afford them.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about how much those early objects were? I mean, I know you have hundreds of objects, so, but how, as a person collecting, how could you afford that?
When I first stumbled upon them, I was originally drawn to the piece, not the repair, because I grew up around lovely things. My parents were antique dealers, and we had some nice Chinese porcelains in our house, and so I always appreciated them. So in England, when I was antiquing for myself, I would see perfect examples, couldn't afford them, and then I remember seeing in a stall on Portobello Road a gravy boat with a metal handle, and it was probably like 25 pounds, which was still nothing to sneeze at. That was, you know, I was in my 20s. That was still probably $40. 25 pounds was probably around that then. And in that case, there was a matching gravy boat, so it was a pair with replaced handles. I could only afford one. And so I felt like it was Sophie's choice. I had to buy one. I could only afford one. And out there in the world is the mate. So I'm hoping one day they'll be reunited. But even though they were cheaper, I think perfect back then, that piece would have brought $150, $200. So I would say it was a quarter of the price. It was priced accordingly to reflect the damage or the repair.
And you started writing your blog at which point in your collection?
20 years into collecting.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But the early pieces were, I wasn't just collecting repaired pieces then. I've collected so many different things. Early on, I wrote a book on scarves, antique scarves, showing them as art. So a silk square, a fabric that you wear around your neck, I was stretching it and putting it on the wall and showing that it was actually art. So I did a coffee table book based on my collection of scarves, which no one had done at the time. And then I wrote proposals for other books like that. But unfortunately, those were a little too esoteric to be published. But since then, every single one of my ideas has been published. So I guess I was just ahead of my time with those. But so for 20 years, if ever I came across a piece with an early repair, I would buy it. And I'm not sure when it changed, when it turned more into an obsession, which sadly that happens. The switch goes off and then it becomes, I can't stop and it becomes very expensive. So even though these pieces are cheaper than their perfect counterparts, it still can add up.
So let's talk, you've got your early pieces, which are around $40, 25 pounds. What is the last piece that you've bought? And what was, if you mind talking about the value of that?
I can still find pieces for very little. My last trip to England, I found a piece at one of the markets, and I think it was like a pound for a teacup. It had beautiful staples, and it was very dirty. It was in an outside stall, and I asked the dealer if she had any staple pieces, and she didn't chase me away as they used to. She pulled out a pile of them, and I bought this one, and it was a pound. So it can still happen, and it had probably been, judging by the amount of dirt and dust on it, it had probably been there for a long time, and no one, I'm sure if anyone else asked how much it was, it would have been a pound. So they're still out there.
That's cool. And what is the most either expensive or elaborate piece? Because I've seen a lot of smaller pieces, but then also when you were showing teapots, you were showing things that in terms of the original craftsmen were more high-skilled objects.
There are pieces I cannot even get close to affording because they're so elaborate and valuable, and many of those were done for the very wealthy. So in some cases, you would buy a teapot and immediately take the spout off, take the handle off, and put, they were called mounts rather than a repair, because you were showing, not only could you afford a rare piece of porcelain, but you were going to embellish it with solid gold spout and handle and just make it a showpiece. So those pieces, there is a little bit of crossover. They're not quite repairs, but they're more replacements. And I have seen versions of those which are definitely repairs. You could see the break in them, but I wish I could afford them, but sadly I can't.
Sure.
So I admire those from afar.
Hmm. And are there now networks of collectors that are similar to yourself? Like, do you have people you can talk to, like, oh, I just got this piece, and talk to them about it?
There aren't as many. There are quite a few people who appreciate them, but not as many fanatical collectors like I am. So, but when I do meet them, it's great, and I love having that common passion and knowledge. So I am meeting a few like that.
In terms of the practicality of collecting all these objects, how do you live with them? Like, do they hold this place that they're special and sacred and not to be touched? Or is this something like, if I go to your house, they're literally everywhere and people that come for a party will pick them up? And
well, as you're saying that, I'm cringing a little. I don't really encourage that. I love people to admire them, but I have them in a showcase because they are very fragile. And as I've said in the past, there's nothing more redundant than a broken make-do, because after it's broken and repaired in a beautiful way, if it breaks again, do I glue it back together and then glue the old repairs back on? I just, hopefully I don't have to deal with that anytime soon. But I do live with them. They're not in boxes in the basement. They are in a display case. They're on top of surfaces. I have two cats who so far have been appreciative of them and not destructive. So I do keep them out of their range. But anybody who comes into my apartment usually makes a beeline for the case, and they do appreciate them. And they're curious, if nothing else, they're curious about them. At my weekend home, I do have them more piled up, but that's where I do most of my writing. So it's like a working library. I'm there and researching and grabbing them and measuring. And I mean, sometimes while I'm doing that, I'll notice marks on the repair or on the piece itself, and I'll just discover new things about them. So I do like having them at hand.
Mm. And so your weekend home, I would imagine, is not close to the city at all.
It's about 2 hours away.
Okay. It's interesting to me to think about these objects being in a New York City apartment, because I think about New York City as being all about the modern, and these are all about cherishing something that not only is not modern, but that most people, or maybe not most people, but a lot of New Yorkers just would not understand why.
Well, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. I have modern mixed in with antique in my home, and I like the mix. The New York Times did a nice article about my collection a few years ago, and a lot of New Yorkers read that, obviously. And I got some wonderful responses to that. So I think in New York, you do think metropolitan, you think sleek, modern design, but a lot of us do have a mix of things, if not a lot of antiques mixed in. So.
I wanted to jump a little bit off topic and talk about the other part of your life, which is to be a set designer. Or how would you describe, is it set designer?
Set decorator. It's many things. I have a degree in set design, but now I'm doing set decoration for film and television. And it gets confusing because the term for on movies, the early credits for what I do or what a designer does was art director. Okay. But now that term has changed to production designer. So production designer conceives of the look of a film or TV show. An art director facilitates that with draftings and overseeing the construction. And then a set decor, which is what I do, fills the rooms with everything else. So I'm given a empty room by the designer, and I get to do what I think is the fun part. So I fill it up with furniture and lighting and rugs and artwork and everything that's in the room.
I was looking on your website, and it was interesting to see the images that would pop up, how environmental this is, which sounds like a dumb thing to say. I mean, of course, it's in a room, but you're really changing the tone and the mood of everything in that by the relationship of the objects. And that's why I wanted to talk about this, is that these make-dos, when you're collecting them in the market, are usually isolated. They're not a part of the original groupings of objects that, you know, that they might have been a part of. So how does your sort of set design mind function when you're looking at these make-dos?
Well, not only are they isolated in a shop, when I see something in a showcase, I make a beeline for it, of course. But if it's a plate with repairs or if it's a jug with a replaced handle, it's in a showcase in a shop with objects that aren't like it, but it's also separated from the dinner service that it was originally a part of. So I've often called these orphans of the antiques world because they are out there on their own, and sometimes they're banished and sometimes they're brought to the forefront, but they are separated and oftentimes treated like second-class citizens. So I find it's my job to find them and give them a good home, and to put them with others like them. It's like an orphanage. So my showcases, I do have mostly the pieces with the repairs, but I also mix in other antiques that give it a nice harmony.
I think you're elevating these objects by treating them as special, which, from what you've said, that this is somewhat of an original idea. Not that you're the only person to ever be interested in this, but in terms of collecting, writing a blog, doing the other publicity-type things that you're doing, you're really taking the status of these objects that maybe have been forgotten or misplaced or whatever, and you're elevating them again. Do you think about that? Is that a conscious thing?
It wasn't at first. It was more of, I love these items, and I don't want to just have a private showing in my house. I want to write a book. I want to have an exhibit. I want people to see there's beauty in these. So when you look at a plate, that maybe you'll see a crack on the front. When you flip it over, you see it's held together by staples. I mean, how cool is that? Mm. It's not what you see in your normal everyday life. Mm. So I love that element of it. I love the surprise. I love the poignancy of the repairs. I love thinking about who owned it originally, how it broke, who repaired it, and then it got passed on, because many of these pieces are hundreds of years old, and they've survived all this time. Perhaps they survived in the same household for most of that time, and perhaps they were left by the roadside and picked up, and who knows what happens, but I love to think about that as well.
Hmm. I have to apologize because I'm a little all over the place. I have so many questions. If I'm rapid firing you all these different subjects, I apologize. You're doing a great job keeping up with my mind here. I was interested to hear about non-Western styles of fixing things, because in your presentation you showed stapling, wrapping. Maybe you could talk just briefly about those couple different things. But also you showed, sort of English repairs, Uzbekistan, or was it Uzbekistan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wherever these pieces were manufactured, they were repaired in those areas. So we keep talking about pieces that are stapled. Perhaps I should go into that a little more. And that is, the Chinese perfected the notion of repairing cracked porcelain by using metal staples that were hand-forged and made to clip on the back of a plate, for example, or the side of a jug. And they would drill a hole using a bow drill at a very low-speed hand-operated drill with a diamond encrusted tip that would go through the porcelain ever so gently and then make a staple out of a rod of metal, usually iron or brass or bronze, and clip the staple on, not like a modern staple from a stapler on our desk, which is right angles. This was the prongs were angled inward, so it was actually clipped on. And as hard as it is to believe, these repairs were so minute and so tight that they could hold water and make the pieces totally functional again. So even today, when we look at this with our modern technology, people are astounded that they were done 300, 400, 900 years ago. There are examples at the British Museum of iron staples used on earthenware pots dating from the year, I think, 800 AD, something like that. So they've been doing it for a long time. So, but then the staple repairs were done in many countries. And in this country, up until probably the 1960s, until really sophisticated glues were used, and that replaced the need for that kind of repair. But in addition to the staples, typically a teapot, if the handle broke off, you could do a wooden handle repair, you could do a tin repair, a silver repair, many, many ways, depending on how much money you wanted to spend on it or had at hand. And they could be either strapped on by using bands of metal that go around the circumference of the pot or the jug or the mug without drilling through it, or you could drill through it and actually use little tiny bolts and nuts and adhere a handle that way. So there's different ways of doing it, and sometimes the metal handles on a teapot or a mug that had hot contents, they would be wrapped with rattan, and it wasn't just wrapped in a simple way. It could be more elaborate and woven with patterns, and so, again, you're really embellishing the repair to make it as attractive as possible.
And those rattan miniatures that you showed blew me away. They were you were talking about that they would be for a doll, or would you say for a dollhouse or for a miniature house?
Well, I have a lot of different miniatures in my collection. So I showed you some porcelain miniatures from China that were from the late 1600s, and those had silver repairs done in Amsterdam. And it was very common for for the Dutch to do these really beautiful silver repairs, and you could find hallmarks on them to show that's where they came from. So these were about 2-inch high vases made for an adult dollhouse, which was different from a child's dollhouse. These were the very wealthy doing either reproductions of their own furniture and furnishings in a box, much like a dollhouse, and they would have miniature versions of everything, including porcelain, so teeny little porcelain vases. But when those broke, and I don't know how they broke because they're very sturdy, but be that as it may, they would take them to a silversmith who would fashion beautiful mounts and turn a vase into a ewer or a scent bottle, depending on what their fancy was. So those are really remarkable just because of the detail and because of the size of them.
Yeah, that rattan handle, that one, the ewer, is maybe 2 inches.
Right. I have a little, it's a little milk jug. And that, on my blog with miniatures, I always show, I always put a dime to show the scale. And some pieces are very clunky, and the repairs are not well done, but they're fun anyway. They're just, they're great to see. But if you took the dime away and just took a picture of it, you would think something was off because it was very clunky if it was an actual size piece. But I do have this one little jug that has a repair so finely done that both the bronze handle and the rattan wrapping, I'm not even sure how they achieved it at that scale, because just to get your fingers into the opening of that pod, it's not like a normal size piece. So, yeah, that astounded me.
I wonder if they sewed it in some way, like in terms of using some type of needle-like thing to go around. Or maybe
they might
more.
Have. I mean, rattan is malleable, obviously, and also it's not like a piece of thread that is limp. I mean, it is rigid enough to you could weave it small. So. And I've seen miniature baskets that also are, since they're so tiny, I'm not sure if they use a needle for that, but.
Sure. Do you think about your blog as being an archive, or do you think about it as being an investigation? Like, in your mind, when you started the blog and then also now, how does that relate to the way you perceive the objects?
Well, I buy these objects not based on the body, which is contrary to how most people collect ceramics especially. I buy it based on the repair. So I could find an elaborate repair on an inexpensive piece of pottery, or I can find that same repair on a less expensive, not very interesting example. So I try to find the combination of an amazing repair on an amazing body. But I'm not an expert on ceramics. I love the repairs, and then through the repairs I learn about the piece itself. So that's really exciting for me, and it really is a treasure hunt and an investigation, and I love researching, and I just love finding something new and learning more about it. At this point I know quite a bit about English pottery and Chinese export porcelain because there's a lot of repairs on those, but there's the odd piece that I've just never seen before. Like the pieces I found from Afghanistan, those defied logic because they were so strange, and the body itself seemed later than it should be, and it wasn't until recently that I discovered that these repairs were done into the 1970s. So that made no sense to me, but then when you see where it was done, of course, it was a war-torn area, and they were really making do with what they had. So it's an ongoing, non-ending series of investigations that I really love.
Through the course of your research, you had talked about, I can't remember the name of the village, but East something?
Eastfield Village.
Eastfield Village.
In Nassau, New York.
Yeah, and you had actually been taking a class from the gentleman about repairing.
Right, so this is Don Carpentier, who started Eastfield Village, who sadly passed away about a month ago. But he taught a course in, it was called Making Make-Dos, and we were learning how to do the repairs as the tinsmiths would have, using the 18th century tools and machines. So he has a little tinsmith shop, and in it are the actual materials and apparatus that they used back then. So you would take your piece of tin and run it through the crimper, and you'd get the beautiful crimped edge, and the cutters, all that stuff was, we were using the original tool, so it was really exciting. And then repairing pieces of the period. So I ended up with a beautiful, rare mocha ware jug, with this beautiful tin handle that, since it's new, it's bright and shiny, but in another 100 years, it'll look just like some of the pieces I have that are aged and tarnished.
And your relationship, I imagine, with him developed into somewhat of a close one because you were working with him. I would also imagine he was a great resource for you.
Oh, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. And coincidentally, he started out in film. So he did props for some Merchant Ivory movies back in the 70s and 80s and knew a lot of the people who I associate with now and work with. And most recently worked on the movie Noah, did some of the tools, and I think they rented some of his early tools, but also he made things for them. So he was still really involved in both worlds. So, yeah, it's rare to find someone who has his hand in the same exact things that I do and then uses them both together. So, yeah, that was a great connection.
But in your friends that are in set design or just that are in the film and TV industry, is it common to be a collector?
Not at all. Okay. And a lot of them don't understand it. My work is... in film and television is really intense. So it's at least 12 hours a day. It's sometimes work in the weekends. I almost had to work yesterday as I drove up here. I was on the phone with my assistants and overseeing that while I was doing this. And one of the producers is a Facebook friend on my current job and sees my posts about what I do because all weekend I'm posting and blogging and researching and giving lectures and doing this. And he said, wow, it seems like your film work is your secondary interest. And I was like, well, I do love both, but I wish I had more time for this because this really is my passion.
So talk me through how when you get an object that is coming into the collection, how you determine when you're going to write about that on the blog.
My blog, I really want the blog to be as varied as possible. So if you look closely, you can see that I don't have a teapot one week and a teapot the next week. I don't have an English piece one week and an English piece the next week. I really vary it all. So I'll do an English teapot, an American piece of glass, a Chinese jug. And then within that, I'll make sure it's not a handle, a handle, a handle. So I really do mix it up to give a lot of variety and interest to the reader, I hope.
And do you imagine, one in your presentation you mentioned that you've donated a piece to the V&A. What is your relationship with museums?
Well, that's another wonderful thing that came from my New York Times article. I was contacted by the ceramics curator at the V&A in London. And first it was just, I came across your blog and I love it. And it was just a friendly hello and introduction. And then it turned into, please come over. We have some great pieces I'd like to show you, that kind of thing. And then I had posted the only known example I know of, which is a manufactured handle. It's called an emergency handle for domestic receptacles, I believe. And it was a patented handle that you could buy at a hardware store you could be your own tinsmith, and it clips onto mostly jugs and mugs and cups and an instant repair. So I don't think it ever caught on. I found a few examples, and the curator at the V&A had never seen one before, even though they were English. So I did donate one when I was over last spring. I was asked to give a lecture at the English Ceramic Circle, which is a esteemed group. I think it's the oldest ceramic group in the world. And gave a lecture there and then met with the curator, the V&A, and donated the piece. And what's really exciting about that is not only do they have the most amazing collection, recently redone on the top floor, endless, I think it's like 30 or 50,000 pieces, some crazy number. And they're in showcases that go up to the ceiling, so even though you can't really see what's on the top, you can just, they're all on display, packed close together. I spent hours just going through all that. They have a showcase that show examples of repair pieces that he said, my blog inspired him to do that. So the V&A is a case of maybe a dozen pieces with blow-ups of the repairs and talking about the repairs. So the piece that I donated hopefully will go into that case.
I'm sure. Did you feel proud about that?
Oh, I was really excited. No, that was amazing. And I got to go what I call backstage. I got to see the inner works of the museum and to his offices, and it was really fun.
Beyond the guy at East Village, Dan Carpenter?
John Carpenter, yeah.
Yeah. Are there other people actively practicing this art of repair, like in museums?
I get a lot of requests, and I don't know of anyone else who's doing it per se. I think artists are now incorporating the repairs into their work as contemporary pieces, as modern pieces. But I know Paul Scott of Cumbrian Blues does that specifically, and the results are really wonderful. So he'll buy an old porcelain platter and then embellish it, and I think it takes on a new life and makes it more contemporary.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that style of working. We were at the show yesterday and looking at that, and I asked you, what do you think about someone that is altering a piece of antique? So can you take it from there and tell me what
Well, I'm of a mixed mind for that, because it does seem a bit sacrilege to take something that's perfect and embellish it. But as an artist, I think you're allowed to do that. I really do. I think that if it's a rare thing, I mean, if you're taking, like, you know, one of the last known examples of, you know, say, let's say the rare stamp with the plane upside down, mm-hmm. and taking that and drawing a flower on it, like, that would be wrong. Mm-hmm. But if you take a piece of flow blue or a piece of Canton china, and there's so much of it out there, and you take that and embellish it and make it wonderful, I think that that's fine. I think that's great. But I don't like when pieces... Well, nothing makes me more nervous and upsets me than seeing pieces destroyed. There was a movie years ago called The War of the Roses. It was Kathleen Turner and I think Michael Douglas, and they have a fight, and they go through the house and break all of their porcelain. And of course I know, since I'm in the business, that it was breakaway pieces and it wasn't the real thing. Just the image was too unsettling for me.
Right. So in the industry, is that common that you would, like, in terms of set design for that specific movie, would they come to someone like you or a historian that's looking for certain types of porcelains and then have someone else make a breakaway piece?
Well, I would think so. I remember even when I saw that movie, it was a long time ago, the pieces they were breaking were obviously breakaways, so I could notice they were breakaways. But it's interesting. And just last week on Gotham, which is the show I'm working on now, there's a scene where one of the characters picks up a vase and the owner says, "Oh no, that's a Ming vase. Be careful with that." And the piece they were going to use wasn't a Ming vase because we weren't able to find reproductions that looked good enough, so I had to find something else and change. I had to tell the writer to change it to this to make it more accurate. So luckily I was around for that, but I'm sure if it wasn't my show and someone had tried that and said the wrong thing about what it was, then I would have written a letter to them.
As a maker and as a historian and someone that's interested in history, I'm so glad that you're holding the film industry to task, at least the shows you're working on.
I'm trying to. It doesn't always work. And I also worked on Boardwalk Empire. I did some consulting with the prop department and to make sure that the toys and dolls were accurate, because for some reason that's one area I find that they often get that wrong. You'll see like a 1920s rag doll, and it's supposed to be 1860s, whatever. I think because a lot of them are very valuable and fragile, that they'll use a reproduction, but they're using the wrong reproductions. So I'm not naming names. It happens.
And Boardwalk Empire is a fantastic show. I mean, in terms of the atmosphere that's created through the set design and the acting, I mean, it's wonderfully acted. But it's interesting, I've seen a lot of bad Chinese movies that do have obvious things, either objects or clothing, that are just not the right time period. And it's quaint and it's funny, but it's if you sort of, for some reason, because it's a Chinese film, I don't quite have the same expectation as...
No, but a show like Boardwalk is impeccable. The costumes, the sets, the decoration... It's so beautifully done and so perfect. I have never seen anything better, so it's they do it right.
So let's talk about Ai Weiwei. Do you know him? Of him? Mm-hmm. He had these pieces that were, I can't remember the age, but they were older Chinese ceramics and painted them. And so it was talking about breaking down history or who owns history. And he's also done a piece where he drops a piece and it shatters. But then recently at a show, someone that came to the show picked up one of the pieces that was painted and smashed it on the floor.
So, as a protest?
As a protest. Yeah. Actually, I don't remember.
Or is that performance art?
I'm not sure,
yeah,
but what do you think about that? Because he was already degrading the history. But by taking the object.
Well, that's political.
It.
I mean, that's his part of his art. It is becomes performance art. It's not just about the piece. So I can't really comment on whether I think that's right or wrong. I think that obviously they've got the right to do that. But it just goes back to seeing things breaking.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of that.
It's so interesting to me how the interaction or the reaction in the artist community about the guy breaking Ai Weiwei's piece. And how I think what interested me is how objects change value depending on the context.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a show of your make-dos in the V&A or the Smithsonian, those objects are given a really elevated status
right.
because they're in the museum. They're the same object that's in your home right now, and it's also the same object that was in the stall that you bought the teacup for £1.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think about that context-wise, like as these objects, knowing that you want to have an exhibition?
Well, it's like anything else. It's provenance. It's how it's curated, how it's presented. So one piece on its own wouldn't have as much importance as a collection. And because the collection shows the history and shows like pieces, and it's years worth of knowledge and collecting and travel and expense, I think that... by the time it gets to the V&A, I think it is worth more. It's like Andy Warhol's cookie jar collection. So he collected, I don't know how many dozens of cookie jars, and they sold for some crazy amount of money. But they were 1950s, sometimes, cookie jars that are at flea markets for $20. The ones in the flea market for $20 aren't worth more money, although I think there was a short period where they were marking them up higher. I think that it... because of where it came from and because he made that collection into pop art. I think that that's what happened there.
Hmm. Do you consider yourself to be an artist in terms of your ability to collect and curate?
I don't know if I'm an artist. I certainly am a collector and a curator and a researcher and blogger and all of that. I don't know what the label is, but I'm proud of the fact that I could find these seemingly innocuous things that no one else wanted and bring them together and give importance to them and have a place like the V&A say, wow, we like what you did.
Well, I wanted to wrap up letting people know how to find you and also the blog. So can you talk about how they can find
it? Sure. The blog is called Past Imperfect, The Art of Inventive Repair. And you could find it on my website, which is andrewbaseman.com. And if you want to be more specific, it's andrewbaseman.com/blog.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you. It was fun.
I want to thank Andrew for sitting down and doing this interview. Thoroughly enjoyed talking to him about Past Imperfect and his collection of make-dos. Again, I wanted to remind you guys that website is andrewbaseman.com/blog. Also, I wanted to mention that I have been firing kilns lately and getting out pots that are about to go out to my Kickstarter donors. I've already sent out the plates, and I've just sent a batch of Unomis and mugs the other day. So I want to thank you guys again for supporting the podcast through the Kickstarter campaign. It was a huge success, and I'm looking forward to you guys getting your rewards. I'll be back next week with another episode. Thank you guys for tuning in. If you'd like more information on the artists on the show, or if you'd like more information about the workshops and events that I'll be having in the next couple months, you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook under Carter Pottery. Another great way to support the show is to leave me a comment on iTunes. To do that, search Tales of a Red Clay Rambler under iTunes Podcasts, and you'll find a page that's linked to our show. Thank you guys for the support.